Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Without putting too fine a point on it, here's what the analysts at Barclays Capital have to say. Italy, they write, is now mathematically beyond the point of no return. So, comments? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, managing more than $2 trillion in assets and providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the Internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 9th of November today, and the nightmare scenario that we're hearing from a lot of experts this week goes a little something like this. If you thought a Greek default was scary, they say, it's nothing compared to what happens if Italy goes under. Except, as sometimes happens, the experts aren't right, because Italy's not Greece. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
At first glance, the dire comparisons seem plausible. At Brown Brothers Harriman, analyst Mark Chandler understands why the surge in Italian borrowing rates to 7% is setting the world on edge.
That was what seemed to be the trigger for the other peripheral countries like Greece to go hat in hand to international agencies to get money.
But Chandler says Italy has the means to make good on its debt. At New York University, finance professor Ed Altman says at least Italy can back its obligations with real assets.
Fashion, technology, energy, and a very wealthy private and corporate sector, which Greece does not have. And there's no chance for our country to survive over the long run without some sort of competitive advantages.
In fact, analyst Mark Chandler figures that even were Italy forced to pay 7% interest on all its debt, it could manage the additional cost.
140 billion euros seems like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but Italy anticipates collecting 500 billion euros in taxes next year.
Investors are worried, though, that the Italian government lacks the commitment to reforms needed to keep that money flowing. And the Brookings Institution's Domenico Lombardi points out a meltdown of Europe's third largest economy could set off shockwaves many times greater than Greece.
Whatever happens to Italy will have a truly systemic impact throughout the global financial system.
But in Rome, John Cabot University President Franco Pavoncello says, don't count Italy out. He suggests there's a more apt comparison than Greece.
Whenever you push Italians to the wall, they become German. They become very tough.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You can't talk Italy without talking bonds. And as Bob said, investors demanded rates above 7% to buy Italian debt today. And yes, I know, as soon as we start talking yields and maturities, your eyes start glazing over. And I get that. But it behooves us to pay attention, as our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore explains.
Who picks the leader of Italy? The voters elected Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. The bond markets want someone new. They don't have confidence that he'll cut back on spending. So who really runs the show? Here's a hint. Berlusconi is on his way out.
When you run up a lot of debt, you're beholden to the people who loan you the money. That's why bond investors are so vigilant. They want to see clear path towards getting repaid.
That's Kathy Jones, a fixed income strategist with Charles Schwab. A lot of people don't think about the bond market, even though it's twice the size of the stock market. You may picture bond investors as a bunch of guys in suits yelling at computer screens. But they're more like old-school gumshoe detectives, beetle-browed, suspicious, always on the lookout for a deadbeat.
Bond investors are skeptical. They see the glass half empty, not half full.
When bond investors exercise their power over governments, like they did today with Italy, they're called bond vigilantes. Here's Guy Lebas, a fixed income strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott.
Bond vigilante is basically an individual or a group of investors who try to force policy actions by selling their holdings of bonds.
But just like detectives, they look at the facts. They don't act because of preferences or grudges. Kenneth Orchard, a senior credit analyst with T. Rowe Price, explains their motivation.
They're not going to invest in a particular country because it is in the best interest of Europe or Italy, because no, that is not their primary duty. The primary duty is to the clients.
The good news for Italy is that it's in better financial shape than Greece. But until it gets a leader the market trusts, it will have to keep paying higher interest rates. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
We wanted to get some real voices from Italy in the show today, so we sent Stephen Beard out on the streets of Rome for us to get some sound. We figured, though, that regular voiceovers wouldn't be any fun, so we got our resident polyglot and our foreign editor, John Buckley, in the studio to translate for us. John, here you go. Here's the first piece of tape that Stephen got.
Contento, comunque aspettavo solo quel momento. Ma io credo che sia una colpa generale, comunque parte da una cattiva gestione legata ad interessi personali.
He doesn't mince his words there, does he, Mr. Nicotera? Roger Nicotera, what did he say?
He was saying that he's happy that Berlusconi's gone. He thinks it's about time. But he says that the blame for the present crisis goes beyond Berlusconi. It's part of a wider problem in Italy of cronyism. And he says that now there's the opportunity to make some choices and people can tackle these problems of bad government.
All right, here's another piece of tape. Cornelia Montiano.
Va bene così. Non è che cambierà niente, neanche se cambia il governo, non cambierà la situazione.
I got that first bit, va bene, it goes well, right?
She too is pleased that Mr. Berlusconi's on the way out. She also says, though, that it doesn't change anything. She says changing the government won't change the situation. Things will still be the same. And in a rather sinister way here, she says, we'll still be directed by a world government.
Governamento mondiale, yeah. Okay. Adriana Ricotta is the next.
Io dico la crisi mondiale, che è partita dall'America e poi tutti ne hanno approfittato. Cioè, siamo stati coinvolti tutti. Adesso c'è la Grecia.
Sounds like a woman of a certain age.
A lady of a certain age who's of the view that this is a global problem, not just an Italian one. She says the problem kicked off in America and then spread to Greece and then Italy and everywhere else. She interestingly said that we have to change the way, that's the Italians have to change the way they do things.
All right, the last one. It's a quickie, I think.
Si stava meglio con la lira.
Fortuna Rossi is her name. What'd she say?
She says we were better off when we had the lira.
And there you go. That kind of sums it up in a nutshell, doesn't it?
I think that's about right.
John Buckley, our foreign editor. John, thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
Here's today's reminder that the market thinks what the market wants to think, even as Italy's having trouble giving its bonds away. The yield, that is the interest rate on the 30-year U.S. Treasury note, closed today just above 3%. That is crazy low for 30-year debt. Equities, on the other hand?
Oh,
let's not even go there, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can make a pretty good case that in the American political hierarchy, city mayors have it perhaps toughest of all. They are within arm's reach of the people they serve and yet have to answer to state and federal governments that often don't appreciate their problems. Eight of the country's 25 biggest cities and hundreds of smaller ones went to the polls yesterday. So this morning we got on the phone with some newly elected and reelected mayors to ask about what's on a lot of people's minds, wherever they live. The economy, jobs, growth, you know the list.
Hi, this is Anise.
Anise Parker is the mayor of Houston, Texas.
Our focus has been on bringing international investment and businesses that have an international component into Houston. But we're also a growing manufacturing center, and the city of Houston is blessed with lots of available land and a very competitive cost of living.
You know, when you took office almost 3 years ago, you had
2 years ago.
You had a budget shortfall. You had some other problems to deal with. How have you been able to do that and maintain the competitive economy that any big city in this country needs?
It hasn't been easy, but people continue to move to Houston, and we've had an expanding sales tax base. We didn't have a housing bubble. We didn't have a housing collapse here, and our real estate values held. And so every little item adding up has helped us weather the storm a little bit better than everybody else.
Greg Stanton, the soon-to-be mayor of Phoenix, Arizona.
In Phoenix, we really need to be working with local entrepreneurs, with local business. Frankly, we need to be working with the federal government as well to make sure that Phoenix and Arizona get more than our fair share of the jobs program that has been introduced through Congress. And then we need to market Phoenix differently because some of the laws passed by our state legislature, we sent the wrong message about who we are here in this community.
Let's be clear, that's the immigration law, right?
Immigration. And look, we sent a message that we're not a welcoming community. In the Phoenix I know, we respect diversity. And I think that the voters overwhelmingly supported that message with the election result last night. We want your jobs. We want your tourism. We like and respect diversity. We're a welcoming community, and that's the kind of mayor I'm going to be.
Finally, Jim Snyder, the newly elected mayor of Portage, Indiana.
Portage, Indiana is located on the southern tip of Lake Michigan. We have the largest port in the Great Lakes. We have I-94 runs through the city, and we're about 30 minutes from Chicago. I want to make Portage more of a business-friendly city so we can get more jobs.
Tell me how you're going to do that, though, because cities are squeezed. Municipalities are having very difficult times. You just said yourself you're selling off city property to raise money. How's it all going to work?
One of the things we can do to make things a little bit easier is our sign ordinance. We have three distinct areas in Portage. We have Portage North, which is 94, and we have downtown Portage, and then we have the south side, which is more commerce-driven. And we have one sign ordinance for the entire city, which is landmark signs. Well, businesses that want to locate near 94 don't want landmark signs. They want signs that people can see so they can come. So I'd like to see us come up with a better sign ordinance that's more friendly towards business to allow more businesses to come.
That is actually a great story. Different parts of a city want different kinds of sign ordinances. I mean, it sounds really basic, but it's so real, you know?
It's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of frustrating because it seems like common sense typically doesn't prevail in government, and that's what we intend to do is make it prevail.
Well, and you're in a position now to do that.
Yes, you bet.
Jim Snyder takes over as mayor of Portage, Indiana in January. Greg Stanton takes over in Phoenix, Arizona about 2 days later. And Anise Parker is the incumbent mayor of Houston, Texas. There are probably dozens of reasons Occupy Wall Street has caught on. One, says commentator Megan McArdle, is its focus on work.
Occupy Wall Street's most compelling message comes from a simple website filled with the stories of desperate people who've lost their jobs. More than 6 million people have been out of work for more than 6 months. That's almost half of all unemployed people. But what can we, by which I take it we mean our government, actually do? We don't really have another $800 billion to spend on a stimulus program that didn't bring unemployment to anything near normal. The Federal Reserve has pushed interest rates about as low as they can go. And as the Solyndra experience shows, there are real risks to subsidizing firms that promise jobs. If the company goes bust, so do the jobs and all the taxpayer money you spent on them. So what about just hiring all those surplus workers? The idea has a lot of appeal. The longer people are out of work, the worse the toll of their finances, on their skills, and their families. Breaking that cycle might permanently strengthen the workforce. It might even help us recover faster, and after all, it worked for Roosevelt, didn't it? The problem is, this is not your FDR's America. Roosevelt controlled a government without environmental rules, community review standards, or powerful public sector unions. The United States government is no longer flexible enough to create the kind of temporary jobs we need, upgrading infrastructure, improving national parks, beautifying our public buildings. The red tape we use to bind our civil servants has now trapped us as well. So what can we do for the unemployed if we can't just hire them? How do we help the 99%? We can temporarily make unemployment benefits more generous and allow people to stay on unemployment longer. In a normal market, we might worry that this would discourage people from looking for work. But right now, there are almost 5 workers for every job opening. We can't make employers give them jobs, but we can make sure that they don't starve while all of us wait for the economy to recover.
Megan McArdle covers business and the economy for The Atlantic magazine. Your thoughts, whenever's good for you. Our website's always open, marketplace.org. Coming up, we're getting into an American university is a team effort.
There's a lot of pressure on the agencies to write the application essays, to fake transcripts, to fake recommendation letters.
But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. My old friends, the Wawa Trombones, the Dow Industrials took a swan dive today, 389 points. 3.2%, came to a thud at 11,780. The NASDAQ plunged 105 points, just shy of 3.9%, settled at 2621. The S&P 500 tumbled 46 points, 3.75%, 1229 the number. Bank stocks got slammed. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs both shriveled around 9% today. Citibank down more than 8%. Shares of GM, or as my colleague Stacey Vanek-Smith says, general malaise, deflated nearly 11% today. That after the automaker skidded to lower third-quarter earnings. GM blamed sluggish sales in Europe, China, and South America. Sounds like a trifecta to me. Shares of Cisco Systems powered down almost 4% despite better-than-expected earnings. A lot of investors fled to the safe haven of U.S. Treasuries today. Bond prices thus rose with the yield on the 10-year falling to 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Mass Mutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years, massmutual.com/retirestrong. And by Atlantic Monthly Press, publisher of Worm, The First Digital World War by Mark Bowden, about the Configure computer worm and the battle to protect the Internet. Listen to the numbers on your own time. Download the new Marketplace Radio iPhone app for on-demand access to all of our radio programs right on your iPhone. Coming soon for the Android.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for October. The Department of the Navy concludes its second annual Wounded Warrior Hiring and Support Conference. And on November 10, 2001, the World Trade Organization approved China's membership. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, point number one. Flying a commercial airplane in this country is just about the safest mode of transportation there is. Point number two. Until this week, no U.S. passengers had ever bought a ticket for a plane with biofuel in its gas tanks. And then Monday, United Airlines Flight 1403 took off out of Houston with an algae-based blend on board. Today, Alaska Airlines kicks off 11 days of flights that run in part on used cooking oil. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Trow reports that while it might eventually help save the planet, biofuel for jets is still crazy expensive, so why the push?
Right about now, Alaska Airlines passengers from Seattle to Washington, D.C. might be ignoring the usual seatbelt speech to read a special handout instead, all about the plane's 20% biofuel blend.
They'll know they're on this historic flight, and it should answer most of the questions that they have.
Megan Lawrence directs government and community affairs for Alaska Airlines. She says the big question is, what's the cost?
We paid about 6 times more than we would for conventional fuel.
Alaska Airlines bought about 28,000 gallons of biofuel, enough for 75 flights. The supplier is a joint venture owned by Tyson Foods. Yes, the chicken company. Robert Ames is vice president.
This is among the first purchases we've really seen in North America.
He's had big orders from Europe, where airlines face government regulation on carbon pollution, and from the military, which sees biofuel as a more secure energy source long term. Ames calls Alaska Airlines' test run a big step, but it'll take much bigger industry contracts to bring down prices.
Not just sort of weeks, but also months and years. I mean, really, that's what it's going to take to grow the market.
U.S. carriers like Alaska Airlines do have one big reason to support biofuels: the wild price swings for regular jet fuel. Biofuel could one day be more predictable and less expensive than regular fuel. And since fuel is the biggest factor in airfares, that could one day mean more predictable, less expensive ticket prices. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Political eyes and ears turn to Rochester, Michigan tonight in Republican presidential debate number 3,462 of this cycle. All right, no, I exaggerate, but it does kind of feel like that, doesn't it? Yesterday, we offered one plausible reason the debates have become so numerous and so numbing. More viewers, hence more ad revenue. Fred Gosby of Round Pond, Maine, wrote to disagree.
Please don't dignify the public shouting matches, which our politicians now engage in, as debates. Nothing in the following definition applies to the disgusting spectacles we have seen over the last several election cycles. Perhaps tantrum is a better term to use.
I talked to author Mark Bowden last week about his new book, Worm, and an especially nasty piece of software called the Conficker botnet. At one point, Mark said, a way to fight viruses like that is to create a new, more secure internet. Bill Pinkston, who, as it happens, works in network security in Houston, Texas, says there is an easier way.
What users can do is take advantage of security patches freely offered by Microsoft, Apple, Adobe, and other vendors. It shouldn't be necessary to do this, but it is. The flaw that Conficker exploits was fixed years ago, and if users would update their systems as suggested, we could drastically improve the security situation.
Yesterday, commentator Reza Aslan talked about why revolution hasn't come to some countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia among them. Follow the money, was his advice. Ted Pricer, now of Orlando, used to live in Saudi Arabia. He says there's more to it than just that.
One, Saudis believe that their government is legitimate as long as it is seen as adhering to its Islamic principles. And two, it is where the holy places of Mecca and Medina are located. And turmoil in Saudi Arabia would create a crisis in Islam itself.
Take your thoughts, write them down, put them in an email, and send them to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. We tell you this all the time, but it bears repeating as a way to set up this next story. For all the ills the global economy is having right now, China is having none of it. GDP growth there last quarter was 9.1%. That kind of growth is creating a lot of wealth, and all that new money means opportunities that for years a lot of Chinese could only dream of. Like, just for instance, sending your child to an American university. But getting into school there and getting into school here aren't the same thing. Chinese high schoolers take one test for all the marbles. Here we've got the SATs and teacher recommendations, student essays and transcripts. So now China has a booming industry of college placement companies that, for the right price, promise to secure a spot in an American school. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the first of two stories about the controversial agencies that help Chinese students get into college here.
If you walk down the street in Shanghai, it's hard to miss the advertisements for college placement agencies. In big, bold letters, they promise, some even guarantee, your child admission to an American university. The price, $5,000, $6,000, sometimes $7,000. Zhang Shuiqin is a well-known education reformer in China. He also heads the international division at Peking University High School, one of China's best high schools. He has followed college placement agencies for years. He says this is how many of them deliver on their admission promises. They falsify students' application materials.
There's a lot of pressure on the agencies to write the application essays, to fake transcripts, to fake recommendation letters. This is just general business practice in China to falsify a lot of documentation.
A report by consulting firm Zinch China seems to confirm this. Zinch advises American colleges and universities on recruiting Chinese students. The firm interviewed agents and admissions consultants, as well as more than 200 Beijing students headed to U.S. schools. Zinch estimates 90% of these students submitted false recommendation letters. 70% had other people write their personal essays, and half of them submitted forged high school transcripts. Two former employees of a college placement agency told Marketplace they routinely falsified application materials. We did not use their names because they feared they would lose their current jobs.
I wrote reference letters on behalf of students, teachers, and bosses. They were never willing to spend time to do this, so I just wrote them myself and they signed their names.
She worked for Shanghai Shenyuan, a placement agency connected to the University of Shanghai. It's one of more than 400 agencies licensed by China's government. Here's how the agency works. A student comes to Shanghai Shenyuan for help getting into a U.S. school. If Shenyuan succeeds, the agency collects, usually from the parents, the equivalent of $6,000. Both former employees say this put pressure on them to make absolutely sure that students were admitted to a U.S. college, even if they didn't have the grades to get in.
They definitely not be accepted to American colleges with their transcripts. But if students tell their high schools they're applying to an American college, most schools will revise their grades to reflect a B or an A average.
The reason, this former employee said, was simple.
So that they can boast that their students are admitted by well-known American colleges.
Both employees estimated they wrote college application essays for 3 out of every 4 students the agency handled.
I usually just made them up using my own ideas. Sometimes I'd browse the internet or read magazines for inspiration.
Over the years, Shanghai Shenyuan has had partnerships with more than a dozen U.S. universities, including the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. For weeks, Shanghai Shenyuan's director ignored Marketplace's repeated requests for an interview. But then we approached the University of Wisconsin and shared what we had found. That university promptly terminated its relationship with Shenyuan. The next day, Zhang Hong, Shanghai Shenyuan's director, contacted us.
These are serious allegations, and we are shocked. Faking application material is absolutely not allowed at Shenyuan.
Zhang says he's investigating his agents for any wrongdoing. Jim Miller, former president of the National Association of College Admission Counseling in the United States, says he's not surprised at what Marketplace found.
There are numerous colleges that are having difficulty assuring the integrity of the essays and the transcripts and credentials coming from other countries, and in particular in Asia.
Peking University High School's Zhang Shuiqin says both the agencies and American universities benefit from the status quo.
From an education perspective, what's happening is terrible, but from a business perspective, what's happening, it makes perfect sense.
There are now more than 130,000 students from China at U.S. universities, many of them paying full tuition. They make up nearly 20% of all foreign students, and this percentage is only expected to grow in the years to come. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Amy Scott's got the flip side of the story. American schools, eager for tuition, facing a growing tide of Chinese applicants who may or may not be the students they say they are.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the Truth in Journalism edition, offered because we almost got caught up in it ourselves today. Despite what you may have read or heard, the Obama administration is not, repeat, not taxing Christmas trees. Yes, a 15 cent per tree fee is being proposed by the Department of Agriculture. No, consumers won't pay it. Growers will. They want the fee attached. It's going to fund an advertising campaign. And also, really, given all that's going on, people are concentrating on this? Come on. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 389 points, 3.2%. The NASDAQ off 105 points, just shy of 3.9%. The S&P 500 down 46 points, 3.2%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.